Okay, we are going to look at the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev. If you have the source sheets in front of you, it is source number one. The Torah tells us in the very beginning of this week's Torah portion, Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz migurei aviv be'eretz Canaan. And Jacob dwelt in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. So essentially, the Torah tells us in the beginning of this week's Torah portion that Yaakov is back in the land of Israel. But the Torah, which is always so precise with its language, adds in three words to this verse, which are altogether unnecessary. I bolded the words, so hopefully you know what I'm getting at. The Torah could have just told us, Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz Canaan. And Yaakov lived and dwelled in the land of Canaan. What is the Torah adding by telling us, be'eretz migurei aviv? That Jacob dwelt in the land of his father's sojournings. What exactly is added by that phrase? So let's start by looking at the Ramban. This class is going to focus on 19th century biblical commentaries, but we do so by way of looking at the classical medieval commentaries first. Not always the case, but generally the case. So let's look at the Ramban in source number 2. Writes the Ramban as follows: Tam vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz migurei aviv, ki amar she'alufei Esav yeshvu be'eretz achuzasam. The Torah has told us in the previous chapter that Esav and all of his progeny and all of the tribes that have come from Esav, they dwelled be'eretz achuzasam. What's achuza? Right, what you grab, it in general, it refers to ancestral land. So Esav and his very large, robust family have dwelt in their land that they have been given. Klomar ha'aretz shelachu lahem lachuzas olam. The land that is being grabbed for them as an eternal heritage. They have their land. What's Esav's land? We know Esav's land is referred to as Har Seir. If you look back in the previous chapter, this is in Perek Lamed Vav. I also have it for you in source number 3, Perek Lamed Vav Pasuk Ches. The Torah tells us, Vayeshev Esav Behar Seir, Esav Hu Edom. So Esav dwelt on the Mount of Seir. Esav, that is Edom. And we know that Esav receives the land of Edom, which you can see more fully, Pasuk in Yehoshua in source number 4. Ve'etein li'Yitzchak es Yaakov ve'es Esav. Ve'etein le'Esav es Har Seir l'Reshes Oso. V'Yaakov uvanov yardu Mitzrayim. And just to read the English, and I gave to Isaac, Jacob, and Esav. And I gave to Esav Mount Seir to inherit it. And Jacob and his children went down into Egypt.
There's no equality there, though.
In what sense?
With Yaakov, it's Yaakov, it's Esav.
Right.
Two sons.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to talking about Esav, Loreshes is Har Seir.
Right. Okay, very good. So the pasuk in Yehoshua doesn't focus on, at least the pasuk that I gave you, doesn't focus on what was given to Jacob and his children. It probably does so in the following verse. I just didn't bring that for you on the source sheet. What I wanted to show you is that Har Seir, that area where Esav dwelt, where we learned about in the end of last week's parsha, that was Esav's heritage. That was his land, the location that he and his family was going to inherit. Okay, so how does that explain the opening pasuk in our parsha? So look further in the Ramban, source number 2, line number 2. Aval Yaakov Yoshev Ger Ke'aviv Be'eretz Lolahem. Yaakov dwelt in a land as a foreigner, just like his father did, in a land that did not belong to him. The Torah is telling us that Yaakov deliberately chose to live in the most choicest of lands. And additionally, Yaakov intended to fulfill or to continue fulfilling what has already begun, that Yaakov was living in a land that was not his own, again, hearkening back to the message that was given to Avraham. Remember with Bris Ben Abisarim? Avraham is told that your children will be sojourners in a land that is not their own. That started already from Yitzchak, and Yaakov is continuing on in that theme. V'lo be'esav ki b'yakul levado yikra lehem zera. Essentially, the timer of the 400 years that God spoke about only is on when you look at Yaakov's sojourns, where Yaakov lives. It's not with Esav. So let me try to just summarize the Ramban for just a moment. What the Ramban is doing is explaining to us the phrase Be'eretz Migurei Aviv. Why the Torah simply couldn't have just left it out. The Torah could have just said Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Canaan, and Yaakov dwelled in the land of Canaan. What is added by the phrase Be'eretz Migurei Aviv? So says the Ramban, what's added on is a contrast to Esav. Esav dwelled permanently. Esav dwelled in Seir, as we know from the previous Perek, and we know in Sefer Yoshua this was the portion that was given to Esav to inherit. So Esav settles Benachas. He settles down, he buys a house, he pays off his mortgage, his family is very happy, they all cluster around him. It's Gishmak. But that's Esav, not Yaakov. Yaakov continues in the path that was set before him by his father. Be'eretz Migurei Aviv. They lived as foreigners, sojourning a land that did not belong to them. Why did they do so? So two reasons. First of all, it's Eretz HaNivcheres. It's the choicest of lands. But that seems to really be secondary to the primary issue, which is that they understood that they could not live all too comfortably. They could not live as permanent residents because, after all, it was told to the Zeda that the children would live in a land that is not their own. The children would be essentially in exile for 400 years. And Yaakov understood that. So he lived not like a permanent individual who has settled, but he lived the Eretz Migurei Aviv, the same way his father lived. Not with permanence, not fully settled. But they lived in the land of Israel, and they understood that the clock that was already started from the birth of Yitzchak was already counting down as they continue on their lives. Does everyone understand that?
I understand it, but yet, and I understand your way you explain it, but yet it almost seems like the plain reading of the words Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojourning.
Uh-huh.
I mean, sojournings imply, at least to me, moving around, where the word settled implies permanence. So,
interesting. Good.
Jacob permanently settled.
Good. Okay, it's a very good point, Jeff. So for those of you listening in on the World Wide Web, Jeff is coming up with a fantastic point. Jeff is noting that the language of Vayeshev implies permanence. Vayeshev means to sit, to want to rest. We're going to come back to that point. But that does seem to be in contrast to what the Ramban highlights, that Yaakov was living not with any permanence, because he understood that the promise to Avraham was being fulfilled through him about the exile. It's a very, very good point, one that we'll come back to, Mirtz Hashem. Okay, so that was the Ramban's approach. Be'eretz Migurei Aviv is coming to create a contrast to the way Esav settled down permanently. Yaakov understood that he was just a foreigner. But the Nitziv, in source number 5, explains that there's something deeper that's taking place here as well. The Nitziv writes as follows: Bi'er HaMikra Amat Lo Hisnaheg Yaakov Kidarko. The Torah is explaining to us here why Yaakov does not continue on with his regular path. What I mean by regular path: Yaakov had a certain mahalich, a certain approach to life, essentially up to this point. What was Yaakov's approach? And Rabbi Blech, spoke about this when he was in our shul last year. Remember, Rabbi Blech talked about the fact that Yaakov had a disposition for fleeting, for running away from issues. He runs away from Esav at the end of Parshas Toldos. He runs away from Lavan. And according to some Eforshim, in last week's Torah portion, he also is trying to run away from Esav. That's why he's crossing the river. So Yaakov had a disposition of flight. He wanted to run away. That's what Rabbi Blech spoke about when he was in our shul last year as a scholar resident. He had a beautiful drasha, which I'm hopeful that you remember because it was really magnificent. So what Rabbi Blech said is already echoed two centuries ago in the Netziv. So let's look at it again one more time. We'll start from the beginning. Bi'ir ha-mikra alma lo hisnahi Yaakov kidarko. The Torah is telling us why Yaakov did not follow his regular path, lefanos haderech lefnei Esav achiv. What does that mean, lefanos haderech? What does pone mean?
To turn.
Pone means to turn. So the Netziv says that the Torah is explaining to us why Yaakov did not continue with his regular soup de jour of flight. Why Yaakov did not make a decision to turn away and defer to Esav. In other words, go in a different direction. When Yaakov is traveling back to Canaan and he hears that Esav is on his way, so why didn't Yaakov just go in a different direction altogether? Why didn't he go to Jordan, what we call Jordan? Why didn't he go to any of the other adjacent nations? Why did he go into the lion's den? It's not Yaakov's way. That's what the Netziv is commenting on. Jeff, can I just ask you to turn on the light if you don't mind? It's a little too dark. Let's just give me one moment. V'harei, berchas ha'aretz, adayin lo higia hashah, ad achar hagolos be'eret lelahem. And the blessings that we know Yitzchak speaks about, when he talks about the land being blessed with an abundance of rain and the dew and so on and so forth, that does not happen until after the 400 years that was promised to Avraham. That's what the Netziv writes. V'harei berchas ha'aretz, the blessing of the land that's going to be this magnificent land, adayin lo higia hashah ad achar hagolos ba'aretz lo lahem. The blessings of the land were only going to be fulfilled after you fulfill a promise, nonetheless, a prophecy, that you're going to be sojourning in a land that is not your own. So Yaakov wasn't going into the lion's den because he wanted to live off of this magnificent land. It wasn't so magnificent yet. The blessings have not yet arrived. Ella mipnei, so why is it that Yaakov changes his course, if you will, pun somewhat intended, right? Why is it that Yaakov changes his course and he decides to tackle the issue head on? What motivated Yaakov to do so? Mipnei shahaya eretz migurei aviv. You want to know why he says in the Tziv? Because this is the land where his father and grandfather, where they had dwelled. And the bolder words, v'niskadisha b'tora v'avoda mikvar. And it has already been sanctified through Torah and the service of the Almighty. I'm just going to skip the Rosh Yetivos over here. V'af agav de bechol makom sheyashav Yaakov avanav hayu le'eda kedusha bekvias hora hatorah. Even though wherever Yaakov would have pitched his tent, wherever Yaakov would have chosen to settle, he would have infused with kedusha. So even if Yaakov would have made a decision to go to Jordan or to Aleppo or to Mitzrayim, wherever Yaakov would have decided to go, he would have brought kedusha. He could have sanctified that place. Nonetheless, mikol makom, skipping to next line, enodome lemakom mishurash kvar lekedusha. You can't compare a location where you are just beginning to infuse it with kedusha to a location that has already been settled by two generations prior of Shomer Torah Mitzvos. So Yaakov is making a decision now. Where does he want to raise his family, essentially? He's left Haran. He's got a whole crew with him. He's got a whole brood with him. Where is he going to settle down and take root? And the whole world was open to him. And quite frankly, wherever he would have settled, he would have done a fine job. But when Yaakov is making a decision, where do I want to settle down? What was prompting him to settle in the land of Israel is it's Eretz Megurei Aviv. This is a land that has already been infused with Kedusha for two generations. So while I could make an imprint on the land wherever I choose to settle, okay, but going to Israel is already linking up, sinking in with previously established Kedusha. And the Netziv says something startling in source number 5, paragraph number 2, and then Chazan, I'll get to your comment. Writes Netziv, V'harei afilu l'inyan kivura, when it comes to burial, so the Gemara in Ksubo says, you're gonna find this very interesting. The kimo de yafa be eretz Yisrael yose mikol haratzos. Just like we say that it's best to be buried in Israel as opposed to any other location. Kach yafa bavel shehu makom Torah yoser mikol haratzos. So too is Bavel better than any other location. Now, I don't think the Gemara is creating a parallel. I don't think the Gemara is saying that Israel is just as good, I'm sorry, that Bavel is just as good as Israel. That's not the case. But the point is, all things being equal, where should a person choose to be buried? So Israel's on top of the list. If they can't make it to Israel in times of Chazal, in times of the Amoraim who are living in Bavel, best to be buried in Bavel, because that is a Makom Kedusha. Shumakom Torah Yosef Mikol Aratzos. It's a place of Torah more than any other land. So what's the Netziv showing you? The Netziv is showing you that we can impart Kedusha into the land. There can be an infusion of Kedusha into the land. And it's not unique just to Israel. Obviously, Israel has the capacity for the greatest level of Kedusha. But anywhere where previous generations have led a life of Judaism, that also creates a Malkum Kedusha. So if a person has to pick where they're going to be buried, better to be buried in a place where there was an establishment of Torah, where there were Jewish communities. So it says in the Tziv, Mikol Sheken Yeshiva B'chayim Vaday Tov Liyos Malkum Mushrash L'Torah V'Avoda. If that's the halacha regarding burial, how much more so is it best to actually live in a land that is well established with Torah and Avoda and the sanctity, the Kedusha. And that's the beautiful insight of the Tziv. That's why the Torah tells us, Vayeshev Yaakov, Be'eretz Migurei Aviv. Be'eretz Migurei Aviv is not a geographical identification, because we know the Torah could have just said, Vayeshev Yaakov Eretz Kanan. I would have known where Yaakov is. Me'eretz Migurei Aviv is the Torah's way of telling us what was motivating Yaakov to overcome his default stance, which is a stance of running away, which is a stance of flight. What motivates him to overcome that default posture? It was his desire to connect with the Kedusha, with the lives of his father and grandfather, where they built their communities, where they raised their families. And that was such a great urge for Yaakov that he overcame his dispositions. He went into the lion's den, he met up with Esav, and ultimately he chose to settle in the land of Israel because Be'eretz Migurei Aviv. By the way, those of us that study Nefesh HaRav on Shabbos afternoon, so we came across a very similar point a little while ago. This is a famous vort from the Rav. Rav Shechter writes in Nefesh HaRav that in Az Yashir, so when the Jewish people were singing out the beautiful praises to Ribono Shel Olam, they say, Zekeli va'anvehu, Elokei avi va'aromemenu. So Zekeli va'anvehu, this is my God and I will beautify him. So there is a personal connection. But the Jewish people don't stop there. Elokei avi va'aromemenu. It's the God of my father, and I will also exalt him. And if you look at Rashi, I don't have the Rashi in front of me, but Rashi says something along the lines of, lo ani techilas hakedusha. I understand that it doesn't start with me. I am not the initiator of this relationship. It has already been well-founded, and it's a ground that has been sort of trotted on already by our forefathers. And a Jew has to understand that. That a Jew can create Kedusha, a Jew can have a connection with their Ribono Shel Olam wherever he or she is throughout the world. But a person can deepen their connection if they're able to sink in with the traditions of their family, with the traditions of the generations that have come prior. And that's what we're learning over here, Be'eretz Migurei Aviv. Okay, Chazan, you've been waiting patiently.
They're saying that Yaakov was not in a permanent area.
Right.
Why does the Torah tell us what he did choose was the best that there was?
Okay.
If this is not going to be a permanent thing.
Interesting. You're saying that in a little bit, the Netziv and the Ramban are contradicting one another.
A little bit.
Because the Ramban is saying that Yaakov very deliberately chose to live in this difficult land as a foreigner, knowing that at least the clock of the 400 years was counting down. But it was not a chayim benachas. It wasn't so easy. He knew he was going to be a ger. On the other hand, you're saying that Netziv is focusing on the beauty of the land of Israel, the fact that it's already founded with Mako, it's a founded Makom Kedusha because of Yitzchak and Avraham. So you could say it's a machlokas. Also, you could say that the ideas are not inherently inconsistent. They're not mutually exclusive. Yaakov, particularly from the perspective of Yitzchak, he understands that just like his father lived as a foreigner, he never really had permanence in the land, but nonetheless was still able to set up a makom kedusha. So he hoped to do the same thing. He understood he wasn't going to be able to settle down fully. He understood he was going to be a foreigner, but he wanted to at least go down that path in the same place where his father went down that path. So I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
If his feeling was this was not a permanent residence,
right?
Why is he telling us that this was the most beautiful piece of
because
real
from the person right? Because what made it beautiful? It's not the fact that they had this magnificent mansion that they had paid off, so there's no mortgage in Mamish. This was going to be the land that they dwelt in for forever. The beauty of it just came from the fact, I shouldn't say just, but the beauty of it stemmed from the fact that this is the land where Yaakov's father and his Zayda lived. And that infused the land with Kedusha. So I don't think it's inconsistent at all, now that we're talking it out. I think their both perspectives are accurate ones. Yes?
Was there some consideration of Yaakov to return to where he was born?
From what perspective? From the emotional perspective, where he wanted to be a part, he wanted to go back to his hometown?
Well, where his family, where he was brought up, where his family had been.
What makes that meaningful? Going back to a person's hometown, why is that meaningful? Because he was reliving his childhood memories, he was able to bring up his kids with the same amenities that he was brought up with. Right, so I think that's what the Ramban is speaking to, but I think the Ramban is speaking on a spiritual level, not on a emotional or physical level. I think Yaakov was driven by connecting with the Kedusha that was already there. Yeah, yeah. And that, I think that that's true even today. When one visits the land of Israel, you feel like you're walking in a land where so many generations have come before you. There has been so much self-sacrifice by so many generations before us to allow us to travel in Israel today. And you feel that. You really feel like you're sinking in to something far greater. So that's why everyone has to join me in May when we travel to Israel, Bezrat Hashem. Okay, let's look at the Malbim now in source number 6. The Malbim, another one of the magnificent 19th century biblical commentaries, writes as follows, Vayeshev Yaakov. Ba'ashir kotev sipur haparsha hazos v'chol inya mechiras Yosef haisa nisiva me'es Hashem letachlis kolel kedei sheyardu abosin mitzrayma. So writes the Malbim as follows, that this whole story is written down for us to understand how Yosef ultimately ended up in Egypt, and how Yosef's family, meaning Yaakov and the other boys, how they also ended up in Egypt. What was the point of the experience in Egypt to begin with? Lihitzaref sham bikur habarzel, to be purified through this. The kur habarzel is the way the those who work with metal, would purify the metals. They put it over fire and all of the impurities would sort of melt away. That's the way Chazal think about our experience in Mitzrayim. It was this purification that we had to go through in order to remove all of our impurities. Okay, it's not the focus of the Shir, but what the Malbim is saying is we know from God that we had to end up in Mitzrayim. And the purpose of the stories of Vayeshev and the Parshios that follow, Mike, so on and so forth, they're all there to just give us context. How did we end up in Mitzrayim? So the Malbim says, if you understand that that's the general perspective, that's the general purpose of these stories, therefore, Yakdim Lomar, Shalohaya Efshar Sheyered Yaakov Mitzrayima, Ve'ofen Acher, Ayedei Ra'av V'chadome. So the Torah is telling us that the events that we're going to read about in terms of the brother selling Yosef, that was the only way to get Yaakov to leave Mitzrayim and to get Yaakov's family, Yaakov to leave Israel and Yaakov's family to leave Israel. If had there been a famine, Yaakov was such a devotee of the land of Israel, he would have left. There was really no other way to get Yaakov to come down. Ki Yaakov hisyashev bikvius. Yaakov settled down now. Keva. What does the word keva mean? The Mishnah Navos tells us, "Asei Torascha keva." What's keva? Keva means primary. It means set. It means organized. All of those words imply that Yaakov was here to stay. Yaakov finally arrived back after 20 plus years of traveling. No way, no how was he leaving again. Vayeshev Yaakov. Yaakov sat. He dwelled. He wasn't going anywhere. Okay. Why wasn't he going anywhere? So right to the Malbim, the Torah is telling us. That's what Pasuk Aleph is all about. Number one, Aleph, Mitzad Shehi Eretz Migurei Aviv. First of all, Yaakov said, as we just learned in the Nesiv, Yaakov understood that this is the land of his forefathers. V'haya Etzlo Ki'artso Umoladeto Ubeis Aviv. This was his land. This was where he was born. This was where he was raised. Interesting, Judy. In light of what you just said, I wonder if the Malbim is really getting to that exact point, that this was very familiar to Yaakov. This was very, very familiar to Yaakov. And it really, in a way, the Malbim is focusing on the emotional perspective. It's not the spiritual perspective, because the Malbim says that's the second level. In Beis, writes the Malbim, so number one, it was Be'eretz Mugurei Aviv. It was the land where his father had brought him up. Number two, Mitzachi Eretz Kenan, Hamuchanes LeKedusha U'Lashkachas Hashem. This is the land of Israel that is prepared, is ready for Kedusha. This is where a person can connect with the Ribono Sholom. So the Malbim is telling us as follows, that the first pasuk in this grand narrative about Joseph and his brothers, the first pasuk is telling us why what we're about to read is altogether necessary. Why didn't Hashem just make a famine and bring everyone down to Mitzrayim and have everybody chained up there and we would have ultimately been slaves and everything would have played out the same? Why didn't that happen? We saw famines that took place in the times of Abraham. We saw famines that took place in times of Isaac. So why can't there just be a famine? That would have obviated the whole story. You could have just thrown the whole story out. What's the answer? The Torah is telling you, well, Vayeshev Yaakov, Ve'eretz Migurei Aviv. Yaakov was happy to be home. Yaakov didn't want to go anywhere anymore. He finally, and Judy, I'm gonna echo what you said. He finally got back to the house where he was raised. He finally was feeling like he had settled after so many years of being on the run, being in a stranger's home. He finally returned back to his roots. That felt very good for Yaakov. He wasn't going anywhere. So he was back, Be'eretz Mugurei Aviv. Additionally, you want to know why else a famine would not have brought Yaakov down to Mitzrayim? Where else was he? Be'eretz Kenan. He was in the land of Kenan. He understood that he had come home to the land that is primed for a connection with the Almighty. That is the best real estate if you're looking to forge a relationship with God. So from both of those perspectives, the fact that it was Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Migurei Aviv, and additionally Be'eretz Kenan, from both of those perspectives, no way, no how was Yaakov going to leave because of a famine. And that's why the Rebbe Shalom had to create a situation where Yaakov would be forced down to Mitzrayim totally against his will and in circumstances that certainly Yaakov would have never imagined at the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev. Everyone got that? Yeah, we're processing. We're processing. We're getting it. Okay, it's a beautiful insight from the Malbim. So let's just recap for a moment before we move on to the next segment of the shiur. So we started just looking at the very first verse of this week's Torah portion, Parshas Vayeshev. We asked the question, why doesn't the Torah just tell us Vayeshev Yaakov Beretz Kanan, that Yaakov dwelled in the land of Canaan? What is added by the verse Be'eretz Migurei Aviv? What is added by the fact that the Torah tells us that he has settled in the land of his father's sojournings? What do we learn from that? So we saw three approaches. We saw the Ramban, the Netziv, and the Malbim. The Ramban said that the Migurei Aviv is a contrast to Esav. Esav settles in Har Seir, and he's there, he's set, nothing more is needed. He has taken hold of his ancestral land, done, game over. He's fully settled. The contrast to Yaakov. Yaakov continued on in his father's legacy of being a foreigner. Yaakov never really settled down and paid off his mortgage and said, I'm done. Because Yaakov, as Yitzchak understood, that they're in the process of paying down debt. What's the debt? It's the 400 years of exile. So Yaakov did not fully settle. He didn't feel that he had come upon the ancestral land that was his forever. He felt like a Jew in the exile. Because he understood, as Yitzchak understood, that they are in the middle of the 400 years of being foreigners. That was the Ramban's perspective. So Be'eretz Migurei Aviv is not an identification, is not identifying a geographical location, but rather a mindset, really. It was Yaakov understood that, like his father, he had to act like a foreigner because this is part of the Gezerah from Bris Bin Abisar. This is part of the decree that was told to Abraham. We saw the Netziv, who takes the approach that Be'eretz Migurei Aviv is telling us what gave Yaakov the courage to overcome his disposition of flight. Usually Yaakov runs away. Over here, Yaakov went into the lion's den. Over here, Yaakov encountered Esav head on because he wanted to dwell Be'eretz Migurei Aviv. He understood that yes, he could access Kedusha, he can set up a Makom Kadosh wherever he would be, but it would be that much richer and deeper and more profound if it was in a land where his father and his grandfather had also raised their families. Attaching oneself to the Kedusha of previous generations is such a profound connection. And lastly, the Malbim's interpretation, the Malbim says that the Torah is telling us why this whole narrative of Joseph and his brothers is altogether necessary. Because no way, no how is Yaakov going to leave because of a famine. That would not have been enough to bring him down to Mitzrayim. Number one, because he had finally come home, Be'eretz Migurei Aviv. And number two, because he had finally reached the land of Kedusha once again, and nothing was going to sway him to leave, except the circumstances that God created through the animosity between Joseph and his brothers. So three very different approaches, all sinking in to that one extra phrase, Be'eretz Migurei Aviv. Any questions so far? On the World Wide Web, I hope we are still paying attention and enjoying. And if you have ESPN up on another screen, I can see. That's a joke. Okay, sorry. Okay, let's... Okay, so let's move on now. We're not going to have time to look at Rashi and the Kliyakar. We have actually covered that in years past. It's such a beautiful insight. I thought I would share with you again, but the hour is late. So let's move on now to the fourth verse in this week's Torah portion. So we're looking now at chapter 37, verse number 4, Perek Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Dalid. So we know that things sour pretty quickly between Yosef and his brothers. And the Torah tells us as follows. This is source number 9. Ve'yiru echav ki oso ahav avihem yikol echav. And his brothers saw that their father loved him, meaning Joseph, more than all his brothers. Vayisne'u oso. What's sinah? Hatred, right? Sinah, sin. They hated him. V'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom. And they could not speak with him peacefully. V'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom. They could not speak with him peacefully. So Rashi tells us that even though this is a very negative story, obviously when you have members of a family that can't speak with each other, that there's a feeling of resentment and hatred, so that's very, very serious. But Rashi says, embedded into this very serious and negative storyline is actually something positive. Writes Rashi in source number 10, V'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom, mitoch genusam lamanu shivcham. Through the disparaging remarks about the brothers, how they were filled with hatred, we learn Shevach. What does the word Shevach mean? Praise. We learn praise. So what's the praise that we learn? Writes Rashi, Shelo dabru achas bepeh v'achas belev. They weren't two-facing. They weren't acting one way in the presence of Yosef and another way privately. There are some people who are very superficial and very fake. And they might be able to interact with somebody in a public setting, but when they come back home to the privacy of their own home, they act in a completely different way. I think that we all find that to be very, very displeasing. It's not something that you like. You want to feel like you know somebody. So the way they interact with you publicly is the way they are privately. And if you would storm into someone's home at 10 o'clock in the evening, you wouldn't be surprised to see what they're doing. It would be consistent with their personality. And that gives people confidence in somebody when you know that what you see is what you get. And the Torah is telling us that the brothers were like that. They weren't inconsistent. They weren't trying to two-face. They weren't acting like, oh, Yosef's our buddy in public. And then in private, speaking Lashon Hara about, that's not true. V'lo yachlo dabro l'shalom. They could not speak peacefully to him. So they said nothing. You get the sense that they just ignored him. Rather than trying to act nicely, they just ignored him. And at least they were consistent. That's what Rashi says. Mitoch gnusam, amidst the, again, this negative, disparaging narrative, lamanu shivcham, we learned something that's good. At least they were consistent. At least the language Rashi uses, at least their mouth and their heart were one and the same, and they weren't coming up with this fake and superficial persona and then dropping it once Yosef left. Okay, so Haksava Kabbalah, which is another 19th century biblical commentary that we don't oftentimes focus on. The last name is Mickelberg. I always get it a little bit confused. I can bring it up just one moment to make sure that I give you the exact name correctly. Just give me one moment. Right, Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mickelberg. I always get that last name a little confused. So Mickelberg wrote a beautiful commentary on the Torah, focused more on the linguistics of the Torah, the actual words of the Torah, and through the linguistic analysis, he oftentimes creates beautiful insights in terms of the broader narrative of whatever it is that the Torah is discussing. So this is no different. Look at what Haksava Kabbalah writes in source number 11. V'lo yachlu. They were not able. So writes the Haksava Kabbalah. I'll tell you outside for a moment, and then we'll look at it inside. He writes as follows. When you say you're not able to do something, so that has two connotations, doesn't it? What are the two connotations? Oh, I'm not able to join you for dinner this evening. What does that mean? So what could it mean? Give me the simple explanation. What does it mean? I'm not able to join for dinner this evening, meaning I physically can't come. I have other plans. I have to go to a class. I have to, whatever it is. I physically can't make it. What would be another interpretation? I can't make it this evening. I really don't want to. I could. I've got nothing else on my schedule. I'm just, looking at my stamp collection. I've got really nothing else that exciting going on. I just don't want to. So there are two ways of understanding the language v'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom. They were not able to speak in peace. Does that mean that they were physically unable? Were they so filled with hatred that they physically could not utter a nice word to Yosef? Alternatively, maybe it means that they could have spoken to Yosef, they could have uttered the words, but they didn't want to, because they had a sense of manners and refinement. And they did not want to speak to Yosef because they were so disgusted with him. So there are two ways of understanding it. Could they physically not? Were they so overcome with hatred and anger that they just couldn't open their mouth? Or was it they could have, but they decided not to. They decided not to. So which one is worse? The former is worse, right? If they were so angry that they physically were handicapped, they couldn't speak, that's much worse. Let's look at what Haksav HaKabbalah writes in source number 11. Yesh nimna min hadavar misibas chesron hayicholas v'hakawach. Sometimes someone is not able to do something because of the lack of strength and power. Kimo v'lo yachol Yosef lehis apek. We know, we're going to read about a couple of parshas from now, Torah says that Yosef was not able to hold back. Remember, that's when Yosef reveals himself to his brothers. He could not hold back his tears. So that was little physically, he could not hold himself back. Additionally, v'lo yachlo echav l'anososo. In that very same context, the Torah tells that the brothers could not answer him. I am Yosef. What? You're Yosef. They physically couldn't find the words to respond to this person who they just figured out was their long lost brother Yosef. Both of those instances are physical limitations. So that's one type of limitation. The yesh nimna misibos hamusar v'hamitzvah. But there are other times when a person is held back because of a refinement, right? Because it's not appropriate. And they hold themselves back. They physically could do so, but they choose not to do so. And the Haksav HaKabbalah gives us two different examples of that. Lo yuchlun hamitzriim l'achol es ha'ivrim. So we know that when Yosef and his brothers come down, so they eat when Yosef and his brothers dine together, after the brothers come down the second time, so we know that they eat separately. And the Torah tells us, "V'lo yuchlun hamitzriim l'achol etivrim." What does that mean over there? Does it mean that physically the Egyptians could not raise a fork and eat when a Jew is in the room? That's not what it means. It means it wasn't their culture, it wasn't their way to eat in the presence of a Jew. That's a very different type than we learned about regarding Yosef revealing himself and the brothers not being able to answer. Additionally, "V'lo yachlu lasos es ha'pasach." The Torah tells in Parashat Va'aloscha that there were a segment of Jews that were not able to bring the Korban Pesach, not because they physically couldn't bring a Korban Pesach, but the Torah says it's not the right thing to bring Korban Pesach when you're Tameh. So that's why Haksav HaKabbalah writes, Misibas Hamusar V'Hamitzvah. Sometimes it's a manner, it's an etiquette that a person refrains from doing something, and sometimes it's because of mitzvah. There are all sorts of times that we're able to engage in prohibited behavior, but we don't. It's not because we physically cannot, it's because we are loyal to God and to God's mitzvot, and we will not allow ourselves to do whatever it is that we might want to do. So those are two very different models. So when the Torah says lo yachol, it can mean all sorts of different things. The word yachol is used in all four of those contexts. It's used by Yosef not being able to hold himself back, by the brothers not being able to respond. It's used by the midstream not eating with the Jews, and by the people not being able to offer the Korban Pesach. The same word, yachol, is used, but it means very different things. Good. Next paragraph. V'kan yesh lefaresh be'echad mishnei panim ha'ilu. In our context, regarding the brothers of Yosef, one could interpret it in any of these two ways. Im misibas minias hayecholes, shemigodel sinasam oso hayalahem bilti efshar, Ladaber imo dibure shalom. It could be that they were so filled with hatred they simply could not speak to him. It was a physical impediment. They couldn't. Imisibas hamoser v'amitzvah shelo hayu rotzim liyos min hakas hadovrim b'fiyam shalom imreihem v'rabi libam. Or maybe it was from an ethical perspective that they didn't want to be part of the individuals who speak one way and believe something else. And says Haksav HaKabbalah, that's why Rashi tells you that it's the second type. It wasn't as bad as the first type. if it would have been below Yachlo, physically, they couldn't speak. Wow, can you imagine what type of hatred a person has to have in their heart that they physically can't speak? There are people like that. There are people that are traumatized by another individual that they can't speak in their presence. God forbid a sexual predator walks into a room and a victim is so traumatized, they freeze. They freeze. They physically can't move. So there's hatred that brings someone to that level also. And Haksava Kabbalah is telling us that that didn't happen here. It wasn't that bad. Velo Yachlo, it means that they didn't allow themselves. They could have spoken, but they didn't allow themselves to speak because that would have been inconsistent with the way they feel. But the hatred wasn't that bad. The hatred wasn't that bad. Says Haksava Kabbalah, that's also hinted to by the Targum, by the Aramaic translations of the Torah, where in source number 11, paragraph number 3, Vila Kavana Zu, Shinu Hamitargamim Unklis, Ve Yonasan Benuzia Latargame, Vilo Tzavon. That's why if you look at the Aramaic translations of the Torah, the language that's used is Vilo Tzavon. They did not desire. That's the Aramaic translation. They did not desire. Lahaktin sinasam. Because by translating that way, what does katan mean? Small. The Aramaic commentaries are diminishing the hatred. Velo tzavon, meaning they did not desire to speak with Yaakov, to speak with Yosef that way.
They were
exactly, and that's what these translators are doing is they are lahaktin sinasam. They are diminishing the hatred. It wasn't so bad. It wasn't that they were paralyzed. They just didn't have the. They didn't want to. Shelo nimnu midivrei shalom misibas godel hasina. It's not that they were so incredibly filled with hatred. Rak misibas ratzo nafshom leval yaavru alcho kamuser levli hiskari vela befiem vilibam u bilibam yarche kumimenu. It again was from an ethical perspective, not from a physical perspective. They didn't want to be the type of people who were two-facing. Fine. Now the Haksava Kabbalah goes deeper, and again, this is a very interesting, somewhat technical analysis, but it's really quite beautiful. So the Haksava Kabbalah wants to know, how do we know that the word yachol is related to the word ratzon, savon? How do the Metargamim, they come along and they say velo yachlo means velo savon, they do not desire. So how do we know that there's a connection between the word yachol and the word savon to desire? Yachol means not able. How do we jump to the word desire? So writes Aksavala as follows in the fourth paragraph. V'yir'esh shepirish hametargamim milas yachlu inyan chefetz v'ratzon. The hint that yachol is connected with chefetz, which is connected with desire, from two psukim. First of all, number one, mean v'tichel David hamelech. There's a pasuk in Shmuel Beis at the end of the story with Amnon and Tamar, which talks about David desiring. So the language that the Torah uses is, the Navi uses is, Vatichel David HaMelech. And David desired. So the word Yachol sometimes is used in the context of desire. V'chemoshe Tirgim HaYushami, we also have a similar translation by the Jerusalem Talmud, where it says, Vayichal Elokim Bayom HaShvi'i. That's a pasuk, right? That's a pasuk in Bereishis. Vayichal Elokim Bayom HaShvi'i. What does the word vayichal mean over here? V'chamed. God desired. Asher mimenu amru hamisajim halokiim chemdas yamim osa karasa. We say that in our davening. Chemdas hayamim. It's the most desired of days. Where do we get that from? That it's chemdas hayamim? It's because the Rishami translate the word vayichal elokim as chemda. God desired the seventh day. So the point is that the word yachlu that we have in our pasuk is found in the connection with desire. And that's why when they translate it velo tzavon, the brothers did not desire, it's telling us again that the hatred wasn't so bad. They could have, but they did not desire to speak in a way that was inconsistent with the feelings of their heart. Okay.
But you have to move off the Don at some point.
What do you mean?
In other words, they they didn't want to speak out of both sides of their
mouth. Right.
But that's a temporary thing.
Right.
Because eventually something is going to have to break and move forward.
Right. That's true. That's ultimately what happened. We know that the brothers ultimately came up with a plan and originally wanted to kill him, and then they decided to sell him. Very fair point. Let me just end, the hour's late, but let me just end with one other very interesting insight from Haksava Kabbalah, from Rav Mecklenburg, if I said that correctly. So he points out that the Torah itself hints that this was the way of the brothers. That the way of the brothers was one of refinement. And they were not these morally unsavory characters who, as a general rule, were speaking one thing and doing another. How do we know that this was their general approach? So Haksav Makabla points out, if you look back at source number 9, the Torah could have said, "Velo yachol daber imo b'shalom." The Torah could have said they could not speak with him in peace. That would have been reasonable, right? "Velo yachlu dabro imo daber imo." They could not speak with him in peace. But it doesn't say that. The Torah says, "V'lo yachlo dabro l'shalom." They could not speak. They could not speak in peace. It means in general. It's not. It wasn't unique to Yosef. The word "imo" is not really. The word "imo" is not said separately. Dabro means daber imo, but by putting it together, says Haksava Kabbalah, it's actually painting a much broader picture. Velo yachlo dabro l'shalom. They could not, in general, speak when they didn't feel that it was consistent with what they thought. So, had the Torah said velo yachlo dabru imo, we would have known it was just regarding Yosef that they had this higher ethic. But by the Torah combining the pronoun with the verb, v'lo yachlo dabro shalom, l'shalom, it's telling us that as a general rule, this was their mantra. We can only do things that we truly believe in. And we're not going to say one thing and act a different way. So the Torah itself hints to the fact that the brothers were of a certain refinement. And they did hold themselves to an ethical standard where they were not allowing themselves to be conniving and two-faced. So I yes, Jeff. I'm not 100% convinced that that's the case, but at the very least I can deflect what you're saying by whittling it down to being two brothers. Here we're speaking about the 10 brothers. In that story, it was just Shimon and Levi, so the Torah is speaking more generally. But there's much more to be said. Whether or not what they did in Shechem was a reflection of really an unrefined character, I don't think we have a clear consensus from the commentaries in the Torah if that's the case or not. So I share with you Haksava Kabbalah because I thought it was a very, very interesting insight. We read this Rashi, and well, yeah, it's nice they weren't able to, they were learning some praise amongst this very negative storyline. And the truth is it's much deeper than that. And Rashi is teaching you that there were two options on the table, and it's the lesser evil that Rashi is hinting to. And the fact he's able to back up the Targum by showing you places where the word Yachol is associated with desire just enriches our appreciation for Rashi, the Targum, and the overall storyline. So I hope you are continuing to enjoy the emphasis on the 19th century commentaries the way I am. It's a pleasure to, again, welcome everyone who joined us on the World Wide Web. And Bezrat Hashem, we'll continue next week with Parshas Miketz. Okay, Yashar Koach.